Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's an issue as old as pharaohs and famine, and as new as today's headlines from the Middle East, from Egypt. The human food supply, it's tight right now and costly. In America, that means higher prices for cornflakes or a McDonald's burger. In some parts of the world, it can mean riots or revolution. Weather, climate, surging demand, biofuels all play a part. The picture looks more and more challenging. This hour on Point, the global food squeeze of 2011. You can join the conversation. Have you noticed the headlines from China, Russia, North Africa, all over the map on the soaring price of basic foods? Is it good for you so far? Your farm? Your bottom line? What are family and friends overseas telling you about their food bills, their weather, their food future? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a microphone taken into a market in Hyderabad in India. Al Jazeera English talking with a merchant saying she's taking a lot of flack from customers upset over higher prices.
Customers are complaining day in and day out. I don't know what to say to them. There was a bad crop this year, and it's got too expensive, so they just walk away.
But you can only walk so far away from food. Joining us now from Washington is Gawain Kripke, Director of Policy Research for Oxfam America. He follows closely global food prices, harvests, and hunger. Gawain, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Also with us from Ames, Iowa, is Bruce Babcock. He's a professor of economics and director of the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development at Iowa State University. Bruce Babcock, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you again.
It's great to be with you.
Gawain, what's going on here?
We're seeing globally, in global commodity markets, food prices increasing. We saw a spiraling upward of food prices in 2008, and which was a real shock to the system and a surprise, with a lot of problems around the world, food riots and export bans going on in exporting countries. But that was moderated when the economic crisis hit, because global demand went down and prices for almost everything sank. But as the economy is beginning to recover, we're seeing the same spiraling upward of food prices around the world. Not just food, of course, other commodities are moving upward. But for an organization like Oxfam, I'm concerned about poverty and hunger. And so we're particularly concerned about food and the impact it might have on poverty and hunger.
I mean, the headlines we're reading here, Bruce, from around the world are really arresting. We all saw the huge heat wave in Russia over the summer, which really hit the Black Sea area, Ukraine, even over to Kazakhstan and their crops here. The UN is putting out a big warning on China. China's state-run news media is saying that the country's major agricultural regions are facing the worst drought in 60 years. China's been self-sufficient in grain, wheat, for decades. For national security is how they look at it, but they might have to take their big money onto the markets. Lots of countries around the world trying to stockpile grains right now, Bruce, with all the kind of inflationary effect that can have. How do you see this year in the whole line of years here? The global index from the FAO says it's the highest prices since they started keeping track. Now, that's just 1990, but nevertheless, highest since 90.
Well, that's right. And every year, the world food supply has surprises, and they're either positive surprises or negative surprises. Since the summer of 2010, all the surprises have been negative to supply. And so what we've done, it seems like every month something new comes on. Dry weather in South America, a shorter than anticipated crop in the heartland here last summer. And so they've been piling on at each other. At the same time, the pile on of negative shocks to our supply have hit when we don't have large surpluses to fall back on. And in part, we don't have those large surpluses because of growing demand overseas, but also growing demand here at home for biofuel. So it's been a confluence of events, all negative surprises combined with a lack of surplus as a shock absorber.
We'll look at that. Gawain, what's catching your attention around the world in terms of the evidence of this pinch? Where are you seeing it? In what headlines, what circumstances globally? Is it showing up?
Well, I see it on. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, Gawain, please. Go ahead in Washington.
we're always worried about the most vulnerable countries and the most vulnerable people. The poorest countries tend to be food importers, and so they depend on robust supplies of food to and working markets to import food. And when the prices go up and the markets get disrupted, then that can create real shocks. And then for poor people individually, the same is true. They tend to be net food consumers, although many of them are agriculturalists. They also have to buy food on the market. And when prices go up or dramatically or supplies are shocked, they can face really dramatic problems.
So we're looking here. I mean, last time in 07, 08, we saw riots and real unrest in Bangladesh and Egypt, Haiti, India, Mozambique, you know, Senegal, Yemen, all over the place. What about this time? What's the evidence on the ground? How is it playing out, Gawain, that people are up against it on food?
Well, I think we're seeing some of it in the North Africa and the Middle East right now. There are many causes, I think, to the social upheavals happening, and yet food prices does seem to be playing a factor. Most observers think that rising food prices is creating an extra stress and a flashpoint for many of the countries in North Africa. We may see that spreading across other regions as well. So far, the transmission of these high prices into local markets has been slow, and we're not seeing sort of the red alerts all over the world. There are some red alerts, but they're not necessarily related to the global high prices. But it creates a real strain. And as Bruce was saying, there aren't deep reserves to go on. The global stocks, global supplies are pretty thin. So another shock, and we might see really spiraling crisis.
February of 08, world grain inventories dipped below a 70-day supply, and that really got people's attention. Now they're once again below a 70-day supply. Bruce Babcock, we're seeing countries stepping up, apparently worried about supplies, you know, within their borders. Indonesia, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, and others buying very large quantities of grain just to have on hand. What's the impact of that when countries begin to do that?
Well, on either the buying side or the selling side, when countries don't have faith that they can always go to the market and access grain and basic food supplies, what happens is that you get panic buying, or you get trade exporting countries start worrying about their own food supplies, and they stop exporting food and making it available. What we really need is for countries to just not a hoard, don't panic buy, and rely on the trading system. However, the experience of 2008 is that these importing countries might have good reason to think that they should stock up a little bit now, because if prices do go spiral upward, the first reaction on many of these exporting countries is to quit exporting. And so the 2008 experience is in part one reason why countries perhaps are trying to stockpile some grains.
Bruce, why don't we have those surpluses anymore? I think at least Americans can remember. It seemed for many years we'd always see, you know, photographs of gigantic mountains of grain just sitting there, too much to hold in the bins in the Midwest and elsewhere. What happened to that?
Two things. The first thing is that the government has really gotten out of the business of subsidizing storage. And so what we've been going towards over the last 15 years is almost a just-in-time food supply, where we have much less storage just because of increasing efficiencies in the food sector. So that's one. So we've just been carrying less stocks around. We're getting by with fewer stocks. The other one is that we created a biofuel industry in part because it makes sense for a biofuel industry to soak up surplus amounts of grain and stockpiles of grain, turn it into fuel. We have an inexhaustible demand for fuel to run our cars, and so we decided to do that. And so we've, at the same time we've been running a just-in-time food production system, we've soaked up the surplus into the biofuels industry, and the government has quit subsidizing storage. So all of those things have really made those mountains of grain disappear.
Have biofuels become a significant competitor for grains then, Bruce?
Well, we're grinding in the United States over 4 billion bushels of corn for corn ethanol 4 billion bushels is about double what we export to the world, and we're by far the largest world exporter. It's about a third of our crop. So, yes, it's a major competitor to the food sector.
A third of the American crop, and the United States, one of the great exporters to the world going. Do you see that, American biofuel development, as being a significant part globally of what's going on with the food crunch, Gwen?
Yeah, the answer is yes. It's a hotly debated topic about what the impact of U.S. and European biofuels mandates is, with the biofuels industry tending to downplay what the impact is on prices and supplies. But it's hard to deny that these facts, that we're essentially burning as transportation fuel huge amounts of food. And that at the least is putting a huge new demand, a new consumer of these products into the market, and we think it's problematic. If the U.S. and other countries are also following the U.S. model in terms of putting biofuels mandates, is diverting a lot of food and agriculture inputs into our energy markets, and it makes food markets tighter.
Meanwhile, Bruce, back in the USA and in other countries where they do have good crops or have had decent crops, I mean, this means great prices for farmers, right? This is good times roll, even if it's hunger or tight supply elsewhere.
Farm income in the U.S. is probably a bit all-time high if these prices continue, and farm income has been strong for the last 4 years in the United States. If you look across all the crops and across the livestock sectors, it's a great time to be a farmer, and that's reflected in huge increases in land prices throughout the farm country. So, yes, if you're a seller of agricultural commodities, whether you're a seller in a developing country or in the developed world, it's a great time to be a farmer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about global food prices at an all-time high, bad weather, stock supplies down, and plenty of fallout from a global food squeeze. Here's a little sound from Algeria. Back in January, while all eyes were on the uprising in Tunisia, there were food riots in Algeria next door. Here's one protester in the capital saying that he's fed up, blaming the government, fed up. The people are just need better prices on food.
The solution is let us go to Europe. Young people today either end up in prison or immigrate. The government is humiliating us. They're raising the price of sugar. We have to pay the rent, the electricity, water, sugar, and oil. We're all poor.
Government's trying to keep people happy all over the place, raising subsidies, importing big stocks of grain. Of course, that just drives up concern over supply. Gawain Kripke joins us today from Washington there with Oxfam America. He's a policy analyst there. Bruce Babcock is here from Ames, Iowa, professor of economics at Iowa State University. Bruce, listeners are really responding to this notion of just-in-time food supply. We all know that the weather can change. Maybe the climate itself is changing here. Liz writes in on Facebook. She says, a rational society would have enough food for a year stored away to moderate price swings and survive a disaster. What is a reasonable food supply for a country, for the world, to have on hand? And is what we have now reasonable, Bruce?
Well, it's reasonable until disaster strikes, so it's a hard question to answer because it does depend on how much the world is willing to share food through a rational trading system. And I mean by that, the more open trading system we have, the less any individual country needs to hold on hand. And so what I would advocate is more agreements between countries so that when disaster strikes, say, in Russia, that we generally think that disaster doesn't strike everywhere at the same time, and so that the world food supply is a lot more stable, and so that the Russians, if they are short, they can count on the world trading system to allow them to access the food. So it's a very complicated question to answer, but I would say that it just doesn't make any sense at all for every single country to go out and hoard food just for their population, because then we'll never have enough food stocks on hand. So the trading system is what we really need to advocate.
But right now, Gawain, it's every country for itself, isn't it? I mean, I'm reading here Saudi Arabia, Libya, Bangladesh, all out there in the market for extra grain. Algeria just bought 800,000 tons of wheat. Indonesia, 800,000 tons of rice. These are big purchases. Right now, there is no guarantee that if you need it, you'll get it. Somebody will let it flow to you going.
Those countries are traditional importing countries, and they're always importing. We've got to remember that. It's really up to the exporting countries to make sure that they allow that access.
Going, do you see a problem there? Do you see any chance of that kind of arrangement where people are guaranteed? Is there enough food to guarantee every country whatever they need?
Well, what you're describing is one of the problems that we're facing with globalization. We have some institutions like the World Trade Organization and the UN that are relatively weak. They're not strong enough to make sure that our trade system survives when there are panics, when there are problems with food prices or food supply. And so when it comes down to it, it is every country for themselves. Countries that are traditional exporters put export bans in place because they're worried about their own supply. And so importing countries feel very, very vulnerable and are taking actions to try to lock in supply. In some cases, going a lot further than just making sure that they buy large stockpiles. You see some countries actually buying land in other countries to guarantee their food supply. And these are some of the pathologies of our global governance system, which can't really guarantee that that country A can supply itself from country B. And in general, the countries that you're describing do have resources. They have the funds to go out onto the market and buy supplies. The countries we're most worried about are the really poor countries who can't really afford to lock in these contracts or go buying land in other countries. And that's where we see the really acute potential problems with really poor people facing really high prices or no supply at all.
If food prices go up, they're just pinned to the wall. I want to walk through the factors that are driving this crunch. And Gwen, let me start with you and demand. We know that the global population is growing. Is it that population growth alone, or is it people within that overall population wanting more food? Is this an outcome of people's incomes rising, so they want to eat more meat, more food in general? Take apart the demand side of this for us, Gowie.
Right. Well, we've always known that as population grows, demand for food grows. That's been
axiomatic, as they say.
Axiomatic, exactly. What's also true is that as people get more income, as they're richer, they tend to eat not just more food but higher quality food, more protein. So you'll eat more meat if you have more money. And some of these very big and very fast-growing countries, India and China in particular, we're seeing demand grow very fast for protein, for pork and for chicken and for beef. And the conversion rate of cereals into meat is high. So I don't know if it's exponential, but it's not 1 + 1. It's 1 + 5.
Six or seven times as much grain to make the meat as to make the grain equivalent.
That's right. And that income growth is something that's good. It means people are healthier and they're happier, we hope, with higher incomes and better food. But it puts a real strain on the agriculture system to try to supply that demand. So that's one element. Bruce, and we've already talked about the biofuels, which is another source of demand that's pretty new on the system. We've always used some amount of agricultural resources for energy, but the large government drivers, big tax breaks, big mandates that we use ethanol in this country and in Europe, they use biodiesel, is really driving a lot of conversion of agricultural resources and food into energy. So those are two pretty big drivers of demand right now that are potentially disruptive of existing systems.
Bruce, what about weather? And when you raise weather these days, you seem to automatically raise climate as well. What about that as a factor?
Well, that would be on the supply side. And yes, weather has been a factor. And I'll just start close to home. Last year in June and July, we were expecting above trend yields, above expected yields. But it kept raining and raining and raining, and the yields just did not even hit trend levels. And so the market was expecting a big corn and soybean crop in the United States. It just didn't get it. And in part, it was because it was just too wet. And that's a big change for the Corn Belt. We've had a number of years of very large, heavy rainfalls in the last decade. So, and then you combine that with floods in Australia, floods in Pakistan, huge drought in Russia, and then dry weather in South America. And so all of those aspects came together on a negative side. It was hard-pressed to find a place that had a bumper crop that was an important exporter. So we have this just growing, steadily growing demand overseas, combined with basically a lot of supply surprises on the negative side. So it definitely has been a troubling year in terms of weather.
On the supply side with weather, there have always been, will always be surprises. But if it's climate, that's another issue. You could have many growing regions in trouble or things out of whack at one time. How do you look at that now, Bruce? Do you see climate change as producing a less stable long-term picture for food supplies as the human population continues to grow?
Well, we got to remember I'm an economist, not a climatologist, but I have some climatologist friends, and they basically say that as we put more CO2 in the atmosphere, the growing conditions in major agricultural areas are going to become more variable, better good years and worse bad years. And so the variability is what we really need to be looking at. And from a world food supply, we just hope that the variability hits different the negative variabilities hits different countries at different times, and so we can absorb negative variability. And that's going to be an open question, our resiliency and adaptability of our food production system over the next 20 years.
Gawain, lots of commodity prices have been high in recent years, but I'm looking here at a financial report on food, and they put it in a really interesting way. They say agriculture is different from other commodities in one key respect. Rising food prices can lead to demand destruction. And by that, they mean starving people. How do you see the future in terms of weather and climate at Oxfam? What are you preparing for, looking forward to there going?
Well, that's one of the aspects to this issue that is very abstract until you get on the ground and you see that people are actually having trouble making the basic choices about whether they can buy food, whether they can send their kids to school, whether they can get health care. So these are kind of abstract issues until you're looking at households in Africa and South Asia, where the high prices and the shocks to the agriculture system have very real impacts for very real people. And which is why some of the policies that the United States and others are taking, for example, around biofuels, are problematic. We really need to be thinking about people at the way other end of the market who are going to be they have no decision-making power, and yet they're going to be living with the consequences of the decisions on demand and supply of food. So we're very concerned about it, and we think that we probably, as a country, don't spend enough time worrying about the most vulnerable people around the world in our policymaking.
We'll talk about what it might mean right here at home as well. Right now, it means good prices for farmers. Scott in Mason City, Iowa. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. A couple things that I've heard are a little bit troubling. The fact that our farmers no longer have to transport the grain in Iowa over to the Mississippi River, haul it all the way to New Orleans with obvious transportation loss, mm-hmm. and corruption of the quality of the product.
Sure.
In the barge system, mm-hmm. Needs to be addressed.
They don't have to do that. Why, Scott? Why don't they face that transportation challenge?
Because now they can take it to an ethanol plant within 30 miles of where I live, mm-hmm. and receive a quoted price, which is the same price that they would have by not adding value to it and dumping it into a barge.
And it'll be ground right there, turned into ethanol, and off it goes. How do you think about that? I mean, that's value right there for the farmer. It may be an issue for global food supplies. How do you put those together, Scott?
Well, no one ever complains or talks about when they hold us up for the oil, and it's a world price, and it's just going to go up and up and up and everything else. And the fact that our commodities now have value means they have to pay for them. And if they can't pay for them, then they need to come up with something that will pay for them. You talk about these starving countries as being a market, and they're not a market if they don't have the money. All they are is a consumption point. And that's a huge fallacy in everybody's discussion that these starving countries are actually a market. They are not a market.
But they are starving if they don't have food, which makes agriculture different. I guess you could drive a little less, but it's hard to eat a whole lot less if you're in one of those countries, Scott.
Well, no, they've got resources. They just need to develop them, and they need to have something to put on a true market, not government subsidy to dump our grain in there just to feed them.
Scott, I appreciate your call. Bruce Babcock at Iowa State, how do you see this playing out over time? Are we headed? Is the era of cheap food over? And if we're headed into a longer era of scarcity, how does that play? You hear Scotty says, look, this is our resource. It's our card to play now. Other people have played cards with us, whether it's oil or you name it. Back off, give us a break. It's our turn to make some profits here. But those are people at the other end of the supply chain, too.
Well, that's right. And the answer to this is a combination of investment and policy. And an investment, what we need to do is invest in agricultural productivity. And Scott's right on the money in terms of countries that are net food importers and are developing countries are often their own worst enemy when it comes to developing their agricultural sector. We need, in the United States, I think, to help them increase their own productivity and their own ability to grow food. And ironically, the biofuel policy that we have here that has raised commodity prices is the farmer's best friend in developing countries, because eventually if they allow those prices to be transmitted to that farmer, he has more money to invest, or she has more money to invest in higher quality
it's
seeds.
It's a better price for them too if the market lets it flow through.
That's right. And so I think that the answer to this is agricultural productivity increases. We need to and the big seed companies in the United States have actually promised us that we're going to go back to a time of surplus crops. And so we'll see if that actually comes true.
Can we do that? Can we all know about the Green Revolution back in the 1970s and beyond. As if the population of the planet's headed to 9 billion, do we have the capacity to gear up agriculture in a way that's not, I don't know, environmentally destructive to satisfy that kind of demand, Bruce?
I think we do. It's a matter of getting the policy right, and it's a matter of investment in research and technology, and it's a matter of countries adopting policies that facilitate the increases in productivity in their own countries, and while we do the same in our country.
Let's get a call from John in Iowa City. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
I'm curious about the effect of speculators on the high price of commodities. When futures markets were established, they were established to allow farmers to hedge their grains
right.
against rain, weather, other mm-hmm. other contingencies. And in recent years, limits have been listed on the ability of speculators to take positions. And there are now no limits, as I understand it. And I'm wondering if this extreme speculation is driving driving part of the prices of food commodities and leading to this worldwide food crisis.
Yeah, John, let us look at that. We've read. I'm sorry, John, but our time is short before the break. But we've seen the French president Sarkozy blaming speculators, accusing them of extortion and pillaging. Gawain Kripke, what about speculation here? We certainly know there's plenty of capacity for that. Is that a significant factor in your view in the food crunch?
I think it's a bit murky. There are some facts that are troubling, which is that there is an enormous amount of capital, of investment that has moved into commodity markets, and including agriculture commodity markets. So money that was sloshing out of first the dot-com boom, and then it moved into housing, and then the housing bust happened, and this money is trying to find some safe haven, and a lot of investors think commodities are the place to go. So we've seen hundreds of billions of dollars moving into commodity market futures, derivatives, contracts in the last couple of years. And at the same time, we are seeing prices go up. I'm not an economist, but economists, friends of mine who track markets, say that they've begun to not understand why prices are moving. They can't explain them on supply and demand, and speculation may be playing a role.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about global food prices at an all-time high, bad weather, supplies down, and plenty of fallout from a global food squeeze. Gawain Kripke from Oxfam has joined us from Washington. Bruce Babcock from Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Right now with us as well from West Lafayette, Indiana, is Holly Wang. She teaches in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University. Holly Wang, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Help us understand what's going on in China. I'm looking at a report just from the last couple of days. The worst drought in 60 years in major agricultural regions, Shandong Province, bracing for the worst drought in 200 years. China does not normally import wheat. Do you think they'll have to do it this year, Holly?
Well, that is a question there. There is a severe drought right now, about 13 million acres in the major wheat production area, which is northern China, is affected. Mm-hmm. Of course, the severity is different from area to area. China hasn't been imported major food grains such as wheat or rice. Food security has been a top priority for the government. But China just started importing corn for the first time for large quantity last year. So the whole world is waiting to see what's going to happen next. The good part is that in that area, China has double cropping. So this is the winter wheat, mm-hmm. and there will be a summer or fall crop after this. So how much the effect will be there is still a question. And the government is reacted very fast. Only a few days ago, there is a new policy that the government is subsidizing about $10 per acre for all the grain producers in that area for them to pay for irrigation. However, that whole area is already overpumped. Aquifer is very limited. So how much this money will help to irrigate the crops is a question.
Now, because China's put such an emphasis on self-sufficiency, and of course back in the 60s they had famine in China, but since then this big emphasis on self-sufficiency, and it's largely been working. We all know, Holly, that China's sitting on an enormous pile of cash. If their crops don't come through and they go into the world market with that enormous population and all that money, what kind of impact could they have further impact could they have on global prices for grain?
That is a scary picture. If a large amount of cash entered into the world market to buy grain, that will definitely contribute to the high increase of the world price, which we've been heard earlier that for other countries as well. But to be realistic, how much will that, since the Chinese economic reform about 3 decades ago, we haven't seen a huge import like that. I guess the Chinese government is trying very hard to do that gradually instead of all of a sudden. And on the other hand, the price inside China is also growing already very, very high. So the Chinese government would do first to enrich its own supply and wouldn't want to add even worse situation to the world price, so as well as its domestic price.
We know that China's worked hard to control its population. Nevertheless, its Chinese people are becoming more affluent. How is their diet changing, and how is that affecting demand for food and grain?
The recent Chinese population growth wasn't very high. It's under 1%, about 0.5%, which is even lower than the United States. The key point is Chinese income increased very, very fast, so that their diet is moving up the food chain. That means they consume more protein, which need a larger grain base to feed this population. This part is increasing very fast. We've seen that China facing a shortage of pork a few years ago, and now the country has invested a lot on livestock production, which they need more feed. Maybe that's one of the reasons China started import corn for the first time in significant amount last year, because they need a lot of feed.
So do you know what China is projecting? It's a big part of the global population. If Chinese economy continues to grow, as we're told it will, more and more Chinese become more affluent, is China going to become, over the next 10, 15 years, a much bigger net importer of food supplies, Holly?
I would feel so. I would feel like China will import more and more. The percentage is hard to predict, because the government is still think food is a national security thing. It's not just the economics. It's not similar to any other commodities. But still, with this income increase and small increase in population, I do see a little bit more increase in import.
Bruce Babcock in Ames, Iowa, you say you think the world's capable of supplying 9 billion people, but what if a lot of those 9 billion people, some significant number, are adopting much higher intakes of food as part of the more affluent lifestyle? What if that pushes China in a big way into the world market? What then?
Well, when China does move into the world market, they move prices. And so what we're going to see is and the idea that China is self-sufficient is not really correct. They're importing vast amounts
soybeans in particular for livestock.
That's right. And mm-hmm. they grind the soy, crush the soybeans and put soybean meal, and they have soybean oil. And so they use mm-hmm. that for food directly. Mm-hmm. What will happen, I think, is if we don't increase agricultural productivity, if the miracle seeds of that the seed companies are promising our corn and soybean farmers don't actually increase yields enough, what you'll see is people move away from the meat and dairy products that are very feed intensive, and that would be beef cattle and hogs, and move down the food chain, if you will, into more cost-effective utilizations, and that would be aquaculture and chicken and eggs and maybe some dairy products. What we'll see is if markets are allowed to work, people can get proteins without stressing the food system. It'll be really interesting, though, to see if China decides to keep growing livestock there and importing feed grains, or I think it'd probably be better for the world if China simply started importing more meat from the most productive sectors, because it takes less grain in the United States to produce pork than it does in China. So the world would be better off if China imports meat and not grains.
But Bruce, let me ask you, is the world already, or the U.S., moving away from that big, from the traditional animal protein sources? I'm looking here at Reuters just in the last couple of days saying that we now have the smallest U.S. cattle herd in aggregate in 53 years. Fewer cattle, head of cattle, I guess, on the hoof in this country than there's been in half a century. What's driving that, Bruce?
The first thing that's driving that is agricultural productivity, because the amount of meat we get per cow and the amount of milk we get per cow was much, much higher now than it was in 1958. The second thing, though, is that the livestock industry in the United States faces far higher cost of production today than they did, let's say, 5 years ago before the first commodity boom. Producers won't stay in business if they can't cover their costs. And so what we've seen in the last feed boom that we saw in 2008 is that we've seen a reduction in the amount of meat produced and the milk produced in the United States because herds had to shrink in order to allow prices to increase to allow the livestock producer to make a buck and to stay in business. And so we're going to see another round of that come up as this next the current feed cost increase, and we're going to see a lower meat production than it otherwise would be and higher meat prices, and that will go through the market, and that high-protein diet just going to cost more to buy.
Holly, do you have a sense of how globally or maybe in China, how they're looking at the climate issue? We saw the highest recorded temperature ever this year in Asia, in Pakistan, 128 degrees. That's hard to even imagine, but there it was in China with these big droughts. Is the Chinese government forthcoming about how it's thinking longer term about climate change and crops?
Yes, they definitely experienced that. In China itself, they experienced a drought somewhere and flood otherwhere, or drought this mm-hmm. time and flood the other time. The natural disasters just occurred more frequently than before. The government is trying to do its part first in terms of preserving the natural resource like forest for the climate. Another thing is trying to deal with the CO2, but this fast-growing economy and industrialization, and that all of those are very difficult.
Let's go to Jay in Pompano Beach, Florida. Hi, Jay. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Holly. Tom, we should look to Brazil as an example. They derive 100% of their ethanol from sugarcane, and we have huge sugarcane fields here in South Florida, near the Everglades, mm-hmm. and the sugarcane grows much faster than corn. We have multiple harvest cycles year-round, and using sugarcane would hold down food and beef prices in America and allow us to export more corn to other countries. I'm all for it.
So move it to sugarcane. Bruce, how does that go down in Iowa these days? We heard Scott call in and say he's awfully glad to be able to sell his corn and nearby for a full price for ethanol. You hear Jay saying, no, sugarcane's the way to go, Brazil's model.
Well, it's great for Brazil because they have the land, they have the climate, they have low-cost labor, and they're the world's biggest sugar producer. That won't work in the United States for a couple reasons. One, we just don't have the resources to grow sugarcane.
Florida clearly does, but not enough, you're saying?
Nowhere near enough, and we have a sugar program that basically makes sugar cane way more profitable to produce sugar than it is to produce any kind of ethanol. So there's no way that the United States is going to go big time into ethanol from sugar cane.
But will we eventually move off corn, or is corn our biofuel source for the foreseeable future, Bruce?
I think that's a policy decision. It depends on the extent to which we're serious about converting biomass and cellulosic material into corn and whether or not we adopt a policy that basically caps the amount of corn that can be put into ethanol. And those are policy choices that I think we need to make. I don't think there's any doubt that if we put a cap on corn ethanol, say, at the mandated level that is supposed to come in 2014 at 15 billion gallons, if we capped it there, productivity in the United States and around the world would meet the increasing demands. But if we allow the biofuel sector to continue to suck up any surplus, I think we're going to have tight supplies for the foreseeable future.
Let me get a call from Boston. Io is calling. Io, hi. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, hey, Tom. I'm really finding it hard to, from the comment that was made in terms of the blame pretty much put on the developing country. I feel like people are missing the point here. The Farm Bill here in the United States, okay, it's passed, it's full of subsidies, okay? So prices here in the United States is artificially low compared to other countries in the United States. Other countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
More so, last year, the Fed's pumped out record amounts of currency,
right,
which the effect of that reduces the value of the dollar. And what that does is it raises commodity prices. So by bailing out these big banks, you're increasing the prices for other countries. These are farmers. These are really like developing countries. These guys don't have that much money. But now the food prices coming up, it's of course they're going to riot. And as a result of the Feds here in the United States, so some guys are getting rich, while some guys are barely have enough to live. So I find it kind of ironic, but at the same time, it's a shame.
Yeah, we hear it loud and clear. And as you say, of course, they're going to riot. At some point, people will when they're hungry. Holly, what about, let's look at Fed policy for a minute. Some conservatives here in the United States have said, easy money policies at the Fed are maybe a factor in driving food prices. China has hinted at that as well. What do you see there, Holly?
Definitely. In the past few years, China has issued a lot more money, M2, because there is a lot of foreign currency reserved and deposited in the Chinese system. So China has experienced a pretty high inflation in the last few months. And they need to deal with it. Then where does money go? As we see these many speculators, the money will go to the commodity market to contribute to this food price increase. So that is a problem.
Do you see speculation going on in food in China, Holly?
Very much. Since last summer, first they see the small varieties such as garlic, ginger, the price raises almost 10 times as high. It was also, but now because of this drought and people start to see the money may go into the large grains like wheat.
Bruce, when could this global picture come back and really be felt by Americans? I mean, maybe you'll tell me it has already, and I should have seen it. But how much has it shown up in American grocery bills at this point? What would bring it here? And what about inflation? A number of countries are seeing significant inflation because of food price increases. Could that also spark inflation here?
That's very interesting. U.S. is the last country to see a high increase in food bills because a lot of our food are highly processed and instead of depending on the raw grains.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the cost is absorbed in between. And on the other hand, the U.S. is the net surplus country in this grain products. So we have the least impact so far. But on the other hand, we already see that in Indiana, for example, we see more acreage this year into wheat, so it shifted away from corn, soybeans, and plus that ethanol effect. So we may be able to see a higher price domestically.
Bruce, I see Kellogg's with their boxes of cereal, which seem to get skinnier and skinnier, have raised prices. McDonald's is raising prices. What about, how do you foresee what Americans may find on the food bill front?
Well, I did some calculations of what the cost of feeding, of creating pork has done, and that's up about 15% since the summer. The beef, the cost of producing beef just from the feed cost is up about 17%. Milk is up 20%. So I think eventually we're going to see those food products. It's going to be the milk products. It's going to be meat. It's going to be eggs. That's what we're going to see higher price in the next 6 months. And we've already seen some prices increase, but you're going to see the meat sector significantly higher. When I say significantly, I'm talking maybe 5 to 15 to 20% increases relative to what would have gone on hadn't we had this spiraling of commodity cost increase.
Americans may see that at the margin when it comes to just what's in the bowl. In many countries, that's a big deal, Gawain Kripke. What portion of the world population do you see as vulnerable to real hunger in this period of tighter food?
Well, right now, about a sixth of the world is facing acute food insecurity. So about a billion people are defined as hungry or food insecure. In the U.S., we spend about 10% of our household budgets on food. But in poor countries, people spend 50 or 60 or 70% of their money on food. And so prices going up can have a real impact on hunger around the world.
Thank all three of you for being with us today. It's really interesting. Gawain Kripke with Oxfam America in Washington, D.C. Gawain, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thanks.
Holly Wang at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Thank you so much, Professor Wang.
Thank you.
And Bruce Babcock at Iowa State in Ames. Bruce, thank you so much for joining us again. Great to have you as always.
It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for your questions and comments today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.